Right. So the parsha this week is Korach. And the discourse that we're going to be looking at, which hasn't been edited, but it was published in the Dvar Malchut system, which puts pointing and a commentary, which is very useful, which is read by many people, even though it wasn't edited by the Rebbe himself. You see, the Rebbe would talk, he would deliver the discourse, and then it would be remembered by a team of people who had phenomenal powers of retention. And then after Shabbat, they would come together and write a transcript. And sometimes they would give it in to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he would edit it, and then it would be published. But so about six volumes of the edited discourses were published. But this is one of those, the many, which are not edited, in a sort of another 15 volumes, something like that. So the verse that it begins with is the opening verse of the Parsha, Vayikach Korach. So if we can just have a look at that. Unusually today we're looking at it with Rashi's translation, because the Rashi is part of the discussion. Vayikach Korach ben Yitzhar ben Kahat ben Levi. Right, you see the Hebrew text there. Korach, the son of Yitzhar, the son of Kahat, it's giving his genealogy, the son of Levi, v'datan v'aviram b'nei Eliyav, and Datan and Aviram, the sons of Eliyav, and On ben Pelet, b'nei Reuven, and On the son of Pelet, the children of Reuven. Now, vayikach, the verb is at the beginning. In English, you put the verb later on. You first of all say who's doing it, and then you say what they're doing. Whereas in Hebrew, you often put the verb first. So it says, Vayikach, he took. And this is a mysterious phrasing. And he took. And Rashi gives an explanation. What does it mean? If you look on the first line of the Rashi in this parsha, you see that it says Ted Zayin, and Vayikach Korach at the end of the line, Lakach et atzmo letzad echad, he took himself to be on one side, Liot nechlak mitocha eda, to be divided from the community, Lo'ore al hakuna, in order to argue, to rebel about the whole concept of the priesthood. And that is what Targum Unculus translates, v'itpalag, he divided. Nechlak misha ha'eda, he divided from the rest of the community, lehachazik b'machloket, in order to have a quarrel. And you've got the Unculus. Just on the paragraph above, you see this root, the unculus. There, it's the first word of the Targum Unculus. That's an Aramaic translation organized by Rabbi Akiva through Unculus, the proselyte to Judaism, who therefore was very highly literate in Aramaic, and he wrote this Aramaic translation of the Torah. And so there he says, "Ve'itpaleg Korach," which literally means Korach divided. He divided. Although it is in the Hitpael, so it fits with Rashi's explanation, he divided himself. He divided himself from the community. But the concept of it meaning divided is an interesting idea. Now then we see a little bit further. Ben, if we can go in the Rashi, five lines down towards the end of the line, Ben Yitzhar Ben Kahat Ben Levi. Here Rashi is commenting on the genealogy which is given. The son of Yitzhar, the son of Kahat, the son of Levi. V'lo hiskir Ben Yaakov. But it doesn't mention the son of Yaakov. If you're going to take the genealogy further back, Levi is the son of Yaakov, the son of Jacob. Shebikesh rachamim el atzmo, because Jacob asked for mercy for himself, shelo yizacher shemo al machlokatam, that his name should not be mentioned in this dispute. There is Korach having a dispute with Moses, and Jacob doesn't want to be involved. He doesn't want to have his name dragged into it. So although it gives his genealogy going back, it stops at Levi and it doesn't go up to Yaakov.
How did he know?
Well,
it all happened well after him.
Well, first of all, Jacob is one of the mysterious people in the Bible who didn't die. Yes, there's Elijah didn't die. He was whisked up to heaven, and he remains around. We actually give him a seat at every Brit Milah. What happens when there are two Brit Milah at the same time in different parts of the world? Well, Elijah can talk better. He's old enough to sort that out himself. So that's Elijah. Meanwhile, we have Jacob, of whom it said in the Talmud, Yaakov Avinu lo met. Jacob, our ancestor, didn't die. And when it says that, Rashi says, it looked as if he died. The Talmud then says, what are you talking about? It tells us in the Chumash that he was embalmed, and it's the only person that you have such details about their post-death care. And nonetheless, the Talmud stands its own and says, no, it looked as if he was dead, but really, but it's quite poignant the way the Talmud puts it. V'chi b'chadi, was it for nothing that the embalmers embalmed him and the mourners mourned him and they took him to bury him in Israel? You know, like there's a whole long sequence. It's the longest funeral in the whole Bible. But nonetheless, it says, well, nonetheless, he didn't die. And so that's one aspect of it. But even if he had died, obviously the souls are active in the upper world, high. And they're able to complain about... I was just looking at the beginning. So the souls are active in the upper world, and they're able to complain when something happens which isn't to their liking. Talking about the beginning of Korach, so it gives the genealogy of Korach, and it says Ben Yitzhar, Ben Kahat, Ben Levi, and it doesn't say Ben Yaakov. It doesn't say the son of Yaakov. So Rashi says that Yaakov asked that he shouldn't be included in this list. In fact, the place where, according to Rashi, Jacob asks this is in a verse that was written in Bereshit, where it says at the end of Bereshit there are the blessings of Jacob, and he says, "Bekoholam altechad kvodi." In their gathering, don't let my honor be unified with them. So in other words, it's taken from a verse that Jacob already said. Jacob actually said a verse, which is interpreted as meaning, don't include me in this communal machloket with Korach. Veheichan niska shmo al Korach. Where is Jacob positively mentioned in relation to Korach? When the genealogy is being given of the priests and the Leviim and the Duchan is where the Levites stand in order to sing, and the whole service in the temple, in the Book of Chronicles, Shenema, where it says, giving a genealogy of a certain person, Ben Aviasaf, Ben Korach, Ben Yitzhar, Ben Kahat, Ben Levi, Ben Yisrael. So there it goes all the way back to Jacob, or Israel, which is the same name, the same person, two different names, but the same person. So there, in that positive situation, the descendants of Korach are Mityachsim. They are given their full genealogy going back to Jacob. Okay, now this is a technicality.
Because there it's a positive connotation.
Yeah, there it's a positive connotation.
When it's negative, it's not.
Right, right. Here in Al Sedra, where it's negative, where there's a conflict, however, there is a concept that the B'nai Korach lo metu, although Korach and those who teamed up with him died in this Sedra, his children didn't, and so therefore we find his children figuring in the Book of Psalms, Lam Natseach Livnei Korach Mizmor, a psalm beginning, you know, relating to the children of Korach. So he's there somehow, and in that positive sense, his ancestry goes back to Jacob. Okay, now all this is Agadic Midrash, Agadic aspect of the Talmud, or Midrashic comments, which Rashi is recording here. The discourse is going to transform this into a perspective on the nature of existence, which we will shortly explore. But in order for us to do so, we will first have the melody of the discourse, because when the late Lubavitcher Rebbe would say a discourse, very often there would be a melody at the beginning, which was the key, the cue, that this is going to be a Kabbalistic, Hasidic discourse, as opposed to a Sicha, which was a talk which filled the many volumes of Likutei Sichot, the collected Sichot of the Rebbe, 39 volumes. But these are ma'amarim, these are discourses on a different level, more overtly, openly Kabbalistic in nature. Oh, yo, ya, ya, yam, ba, yam, ba, dum. Oh, ye, dam, ba, da, yo, yam, ba. Ha, yam, ba, ya, 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 yam, ba, dum. Ha, ye, dam, ba, ya, ye, dam, ba, yum. Ha, ho, ya, ye, dam, ba, ya, yam, boom. Ha yiridam ba yam ba yom, ha yiridam ba, ha yiridam ba ho, yam ba dam ba yiridam ba, ho ya yam ba yiridam ba, ho ya ya ho ya ya yom. Okay, so we now turn to the discourse. So that is in the Hebrew text, page Zayin.
Can I just ask what? Do you know anything about this melody? Does it have a story, history?
I think it's called the Melody from Rostov. Mm-hmm. And it became a favorite. That means in the time that the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe was living in Rostov. If I'm not mistaken, it's that melody. That was from 1916 on that he lived in Rostov. There is a very interesting genre of these Chabad Hasidic Nigunim, which I've actually written a couple of articles about. One is published in a collection of articles on Jewish music, which I can let you have if you want to. They have this Valachian folk style to them. But many of them were created by Hasidim in the folk style of the surrounding countryside. Rabbi Nachman of Breslov spoke about the way in which the Hasidic melodies draw on the folk style of the local shepherds. And he said that in the countryside there's a spirituality which is invested in the grasses and the trees and the vegetation. And the shepherd, who is seen as a kind of a pure soul, the Ukrainian or Russian shepherd, so he is among this spiritual landscape. And so therefore the melody he plays, which might be, I think, a flute was a common kind of instrument at that time, a shepherd flute. So the kind of melody that he would play has this spiritual dimension in it, and so the Hasidim, seeing a good thing, always having an eye for a good spiritual possibility, whether it's a story or a melody or an invention of some kind. You know, the Hasidim were the first to use new kind of steel shechita knives. The Mitnagdim were very opposed to this. But the Hasidim said, look, this new kind of steel has been invented, and it's much sharper than the ordinary knives that we were using. So we think that you should use the new, sharper knives for shechita. And the Mitnagdim said, no, no, we've got to keep the tradition, we shouldn't use these knives. And then around 1850, like after a couple of generations of fierce arguments about this, this new kind of steel suddenly dropped in price. And everyone made knives out of steel. And so the complaints against the Hasidim were dropped. So in fact, the Aruch HaShulchan, which is a famous code of law written by Rabbi Yechiel Michel Epstein, who is generally seen as a Lithuanian scholar.
This is the Aruch HaShulchan?
Yeah.
Not the Shulchan Aruch.
No, that's right. No, the Shulchan Aruch was written around 1550. Mm-hmm. And the Aruch HaShulchan, the other way round, was written around 1880. There is a joke that someone said, now they've written all the books they can, they're now going to write them backwards. So instead of Shulchan Aruch, it's going to be Aruch HaShulchan. Everything will be backwards. But it happens to be a very interesting book. And
you'll see John le Carré doing that. You'll do soldiers, tinker, sailor. You know,
that's right, yes.
You'll invert it all and just rewrite them.
Dead fingers talk, yeah. So in the Aruch HaShulchan, he says, I remember the time of my grandfather. Well, my grandfather told me that earlier on there was an argument about the steel shechita knives between the Hasidim and the Mitnagdim, but there's no argument today. You know, so I want to try to suggest that this is because the price of steel dropped. And if you look at the price of steel in 1770 compared with 1850, there's a big drop. The steel was invented in this particular kind of steel. Was invented in England in 1740, and in a town near Sheffield, not actually Sheffield, but near Sheffield. And so English Stahl, English steel, became the issue for shechita knives. And it was the Hasidim who were using this new kind of steel, but the original process was very expensive. Then around 1850, the Bessemer converter was invented, if you remember learning about that in school. Did you? Bessemer converter? No, chemistry. Bessemer converter. It's a way of...
It sounds Ashkenazi.
Yes, if it would have been Sarandi, it would have been the Betama. Well, I think the Bessemer converter was actually an American process, but that made it all cheap. But I'm not quite sure where Thomas Bessemer or whoever it was actually. But anyway, so the Hasidim saw these nigunim and they adapted them. But in fact, all Jewish society adapted melodies of the surrounding society into their repertoire. So that's the Maimonides. But it's that particular nigun, that particular melody was used by the late Lubavitcher Rebbe when he said a discourse. There are other melodies, or particularly one other melody, which is often sung like a chatan before getting married. We'll say a discourse, so they either use that melody or another one. But my favorite is this one. So Vayikach Korach ben the meaning of the melody is the idea of reaching for some spiritual dimension beyond the words, and in a sense, beyond the world. And that's actually what this discourse is about, different levels of world. So at the beginning, the first paragraph is basically summarizing the sort of midrashic concept that we've just looked at in Rashi. Vayikach Korach ben Yitzhar ben Kahat ben Levi. Korach, the son of Yitzhar, the son of Kahat, the son of Levi, took, literally, Uperush Rashi, and Rashi comments, V'lo hiske ben Yaakov. It doesn't mention the son of Jacob. Shebikesh rachamim el atzmo shelo yizacheh shmo al machlokatam, because Jacob asked mercy that he shouldn't be mentioned with their conflict. Shenema, as it said, b'koholam al techad kvodi, in their gathering, don't let my honor be involved. V'tzarich lahavin. Now we have to understand. The mizeh mashma, that from here it implies, shu lulei bakasha zu, were it not for this request by Jacob, hayam ityaches maaseh Korach gam liYaakov, the whole event with Korach would have been connected back to Jacob. So that's a striking thing. V'lech ora, and at first sight, eich shayach lomad davar kazeh la'avod bichlal. How can you say such a thing about the avot, about the patriarchs? In other words, somehow the patriarchs are involved in this concept, this issue that Korach is generating with this v'itpalag, this division that he's creating. How, and were it not that Jacob had asked not to be mentioned, he would have been mentioned. Now how could that be? Especially about Jacob, the choice of the patriarchs.
Why is it the choice of the patriarchs?
He is the one. His bed was whole. In other words, all his children remained part of the Jewish people. Abraham had Ishmael and Isaac. Ishmael is not part of the Jewish people. Isaac had Jacob and Esau. So Esau is not part of the Jewish people. Whereas Yaakov had many children, and all of those children are part of the Jewish people. Right? So he, and he is the one who gets the name Yisrael. So the children of Yaakov are the Jewish people.
Who gave him the title Bechir HaAvot?
It's an interesting question, and I don't know the answer where this first comes. Let's have a look at the footnote 3. Bereshit Rabbah, Perek Ayin Vav, Zohar Chelek Aleph, and then Shah HaPsukim of the Arizal. Now, it's giving this footnote, it could well be to this phrase. So you've got it there in Midrash Rabbah and in the Zohar, and in the Lurianic writing. So there you've got a little pedigree for that phrase.
Where are we?
So we are now on line 7 of the middle.
Thanks.
Yeah, ignore the lines on the outside, the lines in the middle. Ve'od tzarich la'avin ma shekatub b'gemara. We also have to consider, understand what it says in the Talmud in Sanhedrin, Al pasuk po Korach ben Yitzhar, on the verse Korach the son of Yitzhar, that it says there, why is his name Korach? Shenaasa Korcha b'Yisrael. He made a bald spot. Through him came a bald spot in the Jewish people. Korcha, yes, Korach from Kereach means a bald person. Ben Yitzhar, the son of Yitzhar. Now, Yitzhar relates to a word, Tzoharayim. Shehetiach alav et kol ha'olam katzoharayim. He boiled the whole world around him like at noon. So, he got the whole idea of noon, the bright midday. We have to understand why, when we want to explain the action, the event that happened through Korach, it's described in terms of baldness, a place where there is no hair, where the hair has fallen out. What's the other image? Boiling up the whole world like at noon. And another point to understand, why the Targum, the Aramaic translation is, which means divided, The bechol makom atagum de vayikach unasiv. Normally, the translation, the Aramaic translation of the word vayikach, is v'nasiv. V'nasiv is a word which means and he took. V'kan mitagem v'itpaleg. And here it explains he divided. Now, obviously, and he took would be difficult to make sense. So we can understand the Targum trying to find some word which more or less fits with Vayikach and fits with the sense of the story. And Rashi tried to help us understand why this choice of wording, the Itpeleg, he divided, Rashi put that into the context of the story. He divided himself from the community by making a machloket, by making a dispute. However, the concept here is going to be taken in a completely different way. We're going to be talking about the division between worlds. We're taking another route.
What language did he originally give this in?
Who?
The Rebbe.
Oh, the very good question. The Rebbe spoke in Yiddish, and when it was transcribed, it would be transcribed in Hebrew. Which, if you've ever done that yourself, you know that Hebrew is very succinct. Hebrew, like three lines in Yiddish would be two lines in Hebrew. It's apart from other considerations. The Sichot were originally transcribed in Yiddish with the idea that women would be able to study the Sichot. So all the first volumes of the Sichot, the first 9-10 volumes, were all in Yiddish. So they were accessible to women who then were less likely to read Hebrew than Yiddish. As more and more Israeli people got involved with Chabad, the balance actually, and maybe certain aspects of the education system, the balance changed, and it would be more likely that a girl would read Hebrew than Yiddish. So eventually they began publishing the Sichot in Hebrew. And now all of them are being translated into Ivrit. So one can get the whole of Likutei Sichot in Ivrit. Whereas in their original form, many volumes were in Yiddish and some volumes were in Hebrew. Lashon HaKodesh. Not exactly Ivrit. Okay, so now these are what you might call the Nigle questions, the revealed part of the Torah questions. And it's interesting that in a halachic discussion you can have questions on a piece of halacha. When the Talmud or the Midrash has an Agadah, has a story dimension, which this is like a story, so it's not so common to have searching questions about it, but there is such a tradition. It's the Drush, the Drasha tradition, which goes back, has a long pedigree. A foremost exponent of it was the Maharal of Prague, who would take an agadata, a story or an interpretation of a verse from the Talmud, and would reveal in it a whole philosophical dimension that you never imagined was in that story, in that little explanation of a verse. So this is following that kind of technique. So Bet. Let's first explain the first point. Shemashma'ut ha'inyan hu, it's implying, shelulei bakashat rachamim, were it not for Jacob asking mercy on himself, hayam ityaches ma'aseh Korach gam le'Yakov avinu, the whole event with Korach would have referred back also to Jacob. V'yuvan ze b'haktim t'chila inyanam shel ha'avot. Now first, in order to understand this, we have to know what are the Avot, what are the patriarchs, Abram, Isaac, and Jacob, what's so significant about them? We have them in our Tefillah, in the beginning of the Amidah, the Shmona Esra, Elekei Abraham, Elekei Yitzchak, Elekei Yaakov. We speak about them, the God of Abram, God of Isaac, God of Jacob. What's so significant about them? Dehine Yedua. Because it's known. She'inyan Havot. The nature of the patriarchs, their inyan, their cosa nostra, you know, their thing, what they are trying to do, hu lahamshich Gilui Elokut Ba'olam. They are trying to draw down a revelation of godliness into the world. So we're on page Chet, first line. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to draw godliness into the world. V'hainu, that means Sha'olam mitzad atzmo b'chinat helem. The world in itself has the quality of concealment. Now notice that word helem on line 2. It's the same letters as the word ha'olam, the world, the universe. Only if you point it differently, instead of it saying world, it says concealment. The world, by definition, is concealment of the divine.
Helem is concealment?
Yeah.
No connection to helem, like shock.
That's without the ayin.
Right. I always ask these questions, and you always say that. They're always without an ayin.
I think so. Yes? Am I right? Not necessarily.
No, I always ask that. Yeah.
No, you see, lahalim means to hide. Hu ma'alim et zeh mimeni. He's hiding something from me. You know. Val yedei avodat ha'avod bichlal. Through, so in other words, existence is a concealment of the divine. That's the whole nature of existence. The Kabbalistic narrative about the way in which the world comes into existence is a story of concealment of radiance, a concealment of divine radiance. There's the Tzimtzum at the very beginning of creation, before creation. Tzimtzum, the pre-Hasidic Kabbalists disputed exactly how you translate the word Tzimtzum, but there's a strain among them which the Hasidim follow that it means the veiling. It doesn't mean taking away of radiance, but it's a veiling of radiance. It's an intense veiling of radiance which comes eventually to the physical world in which we're living. It's as if the divine radiance has been concealed so that world emerges. What we see is world. There's a beautiful image later on, I'm not sure that we'll get as far as that, where it's described in terms of the creation of dry land. So in the 6 days of creation, it describes what happens with the formation of dry land. That the waters separate away and are drawn el makom echad to a certain place. And then the dry land will be seen. Now this is taken as also applying to a spiritual dimension. The radiance is, as it were, withdrawn so that the dry land, which is the physical universe, is revealed. So the physical universe that we're in is like the dry land which has been revealed by the spiritual waters being withdrawn or concealed in such a way, it's as if there was a very, very bright light that was so intense, and then that light is somehow filtered, and instead of just seeing a complete mass of infinite radiance you can't even look at, suddenly you see there's a world with colors and with forms and with mountains and streams, and there it is. Beautiful as the world is, it's still a concealment of the divine. And the task of the avod, of the patriarchs, is to reveal godliness in the world. V'al-yedei avodat ha'avod, line 2, through the service of the patriarchs in general, u'bifchat avodato shel Yaakov, and especially the service of Jacob, b'chi ha'avod, Zeruth, that term has a force. You were right to
Bechir is
Bechir, the chosen one.
If I had to choose, I would choose Abraham. Jacob wasn't.
You mean Jacob was a complex character?
Yeah, he was very complex. Exactly. I think Abraham really did the major stage, and his belief was total. Indeed, one of his sons wasn't Jewish, but his faith was total.
But you could ask, I mean, is the measure faith? Do you think that Yaakov had less faith?
Well, I think he made a breakthrough, Abraham, and Jacob just continued the line. I would have chosen Abraham, but of course, who am I to choose? I mean, the first time I'm hearing that Jacob is the chosen.
Each one of them is very significant.
What is Jacob associated with? Like Avraham, we say is Chesed, and then Yitzchak is
Gvura,
and then Jacob is
Rachamim. That's the next sphere. Yeah.
So does that have any?
Well, yes, it's an interesting thing. That's a very good point to mention. In fact, hoping that we'll get there, I prepared a further handout. So this side has got the Svilhot and so there you see Chesed, kindness, and Gvura, severity. Kindness on the right and severity on the left. So mercy, or Rachamim, or Tiferet, which is the center, that's Yaakov. There's some extra quality about being in the center position, rather than the right or the left, which is another point, if you like, why Yaakov is in this special. See, Yaakov is like the Amud HaEmtzai. It's the central column. And if we were putting figures from the biblical figures, biblical characters, to these Sfirah, Moshe is Da'at, that's in the middle at the top. Yaakov is there, in the middle over here, mercy. And Yosef is Yesod, which is dedication. So those are three key figures. Moshe, Yaakov, and Yosef, not in chronological order, who represent the central comet. So through the service of the Avot, and especially Yaakov, line 3, Nimshach Gilu Elakut Ba'olam, revelation of the divine is drawn into the world. Now here we have a key verse which becomes fundamental in this discourse, where there is a distinction between the Avot and what's going to happen later. This is when Moshe, this is in the Sedra Va'era, the second Sedra in Shemot. The first Sedra, we have the whole idea of the Jews becoming slaves and the birth of Moshe. Moshe killing the Egyptian, and as a result running away from the land of Egypt and being somewhere else in Midian, then coming back later in order to bring the Jews out of slavery. And he starts doing what God told him to do, and immediately things go wrong. Everything gets worse. Pharaoh says from now on they're not going to be given straw to make the bricks, but they have to make the same number of bricks. The people complain at Moshe, why have you done bad to us? Why have you caused all this trouble for us? And Moshe complains to God. So then the beginning of the next parsha, God says, Va'era el Avraham el Yitzhak ve'el Yaakov bekel shein dalad yud. I was revealed to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob through my name, shein dalad yud. Now that's the crucial name over here. Whereas Ushmi Hashem, but my name Yudke Vavke, the Tetragrammaton, Lonodati Lahem, I wasn't known by them through the name Yudke Vavke. Now there's an immediate question over there, because in fact we do find the name Yudke Vavke used earlier in relation to Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. And the way that the commentators explain is that the quality of, some spiritual quality of Yudke Vavke was not achieved by them. Now, what's going to be the thread of this discourse? Because it's a very long discourse, we're not going to get through every word of it. I need to tell you bits from the future, as it were. Is that the way in which the patriarchs, the patriarchs are revealing godliness in the world. But they're revealing godliness in the world according to the rules of nature. Using the rules of nature, one can reveal godliness in the world. And that's basically what Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were doing. When we get to Moshe, he's revealing godliness in the world on a higher level. And that's the level of Yud Kei Vav Kei, with miracles beyond nature, such as the splitting of the Red Sea or something like that. However, moving back to the Avot, we understand what is the power of the Avot. The power of the Avot is to reveal the name Shin Dalet Yud. Now, without the Avot, which divine name is manifest? Because in a sense, the divine is manifest even if you don't have the Avot, even if you don't have the patriarchs. It's a Jewish spiritual Hasidic belief that every human being is able to perceive the divine in existence. They don't need to have heard about the Jewish tradition or anything like that to be able to perceive that there is a divine quality in existence. And in fact, that's the name Elohim. Now, the name Elohim, as has often been mentioned here, has got the same numerical value as
Hateva.
That's right, nature. Elohim has a numerical value of nature. So that's content which adds up to 86. Elohim adds up to 86, and if you would say Hateva, nature with a capital N. Hateva. So nature with a hey in front of it has the same figure. So in other words, existence expresses the name Elohim. What happens with the Avot is that they are going to reveal a higher dimension of Elokud in a revealed way. Elohim is concealed in nature. Now, as it goes on to say over here, in fact, on line 5, Lefi shehitavut ha'alon ha'olam hu mishem Elohim. Because the coming into existence of the world is from the name Elohim b'gematria teva. In gematria, the word nature. Elohim, of course, not spelt with a kuf, but with a he. Shehu inyan ha'elem behester, which nature means concealment. Even though it might be a very beautiful concealment, it's still a concealment. It's concealing. One of the things about nature is that it happens regularly. So because it happens regularly, people take it for granted. The wonder that often you think of it in terms of a child. You know, a child sees, we have a mechutan, the parents of one of my children's spouses. So he teaches in a school in California, 10-year-olds, in a Chabad school. So he has a little thing he does every year. He gets eggs and he incubates them in the classroom. And then the children see the eggs hatch into little chicks. And for years, for something like 30 years, he's been doing this every year. And it's a tremendous experience for the children to see these eggs hatch into little chicks. You know, like this transformation which is taking place. It's a most incredible experience. And our problem as adults in the Western world is taking things for granted. The what did Max Weber call it? The something like the despiritualization. He used a different word. Not exactly demystifying. Something, you know, like removing the magic, as it were. Removing the thrill of the sense of the spiritual, which is there in the world. Of course, this spiritual can...
Demystification.
That's what Aggie said. I don't think it's quite that. It's not that. It's something close to that. He only said it once in some obscure article, but it became very famous.
But if that poses such an obstacle to us, then why is the word structured that way? why does it operate that way?
You mean why?
We would find it much easier to discover the spiritual side of existence if it wasn't so hidden, or it wasn't so, you know, if we didn't take things for granted.
You know, that's up to our own mind. Our mind tends to impose order, even when the order is not really there. We tend to experience life as an approximation. And that approximation is more Cartesian than it really is. Mm-hmm. So for some people, you understand, we expect things to run according to certain norms. And we devise modes of behavior which sort of justify and, you know, implement these norms. People have commented on eating habits. You know, there's very exact, you know, in England you have certain plates and then certain knives and forks. The fish forks are on the outside and the fish knives. And the, you know, it's all... We're taking one of the most animal parts of our activity and we're making it into some kind of ritualized activity. In China, I think, in pre-communist China, there were enormous rituals around food, the way in which people would eat. You know, so we're imposing a kind of order on things. But that's us. If we think Bereshit bara Elokim et haShamayim et haAretz, in the beginning God created heaven and earth, and you start looking around at the world in those terms, and you see a chick being born from an egg, or a leaf growing, or the wonder of a baby being born, incredible wonder. So this is just one peels away that routinized way of seeing the world. And another Weberian term, he talks about routinized charisma, that you have one kind of charismatic person who is charismatic and glows and everyone relates to that person in a very intense way, and then the charisma is routinized so that you have a kind of a dynasty, and as you go along the dynasty, the person who is holding that office is not so necessarily such a charismatic personality, but the office is now something, you know, the fact that he is in this particular position. So there's that routinization of life. Disenchantment. Mm-hmm. That's the word. Mm-hmm. Disenchantment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the process of modernization and secularization is one of disenchantment of the world. That you stop seeing the world as an enchanted world, a beautiful world in which everything that happens is an expression of something animistic, some sort of spiritual force which is operating, if not a wholesome relationship with the divine. And it's all secularized. Yes, of course it's like that. the simplifications of the scientific method. So that's the concealment of the name Elohim. So in other words, the answer to you, Agi, is that God hides, and our job is to find God. And the famous story of the Baal Shem Tov, who found a little boy who was crying. And he says to the little boy, why are you crying? Do you know the end of the story, Akima?
I think I've heard it, but I can't remember.
The little boy said, anyone else know? The little boy said, I'm crying because me and my friends, we were playing hide and seek. And it was my turn to hide, and I hid, and no one came to look for me. They just went off and played by themselves. So the Baal Shem Tov said, that's exactly what God says. I'm hiding, and no one's coming to look for me. So that's the challenge of life.
Hiding a bit too well. He's hiding a bit too well. That's the problem.
Sometimes. You know, you're right. You know, when you're talking, you know, you visit Auschwitz, you see the crematoria there, and for many people, that expresses an ultimate hiding of God. For others, not so. You know, they feel that God's hiddenness is itself a revelation.
And isn't it essential for us to still have our free will?
So in other words, if God were more revealed, we wouldn't have free will. Yes, all right.
Or not to the same extent.
Yeah. Right. But at the same time, one can peel off a few layers. And like this relative, this my daughter-in-law's father, who believes this, he's not teaching these children biology, he's teaching them Chumash. But the, you know, the eggs hatching into chicks, that's part of his Torah lessons. And I think it's a very valuable lesson that he's teaching. Okay, so now we're in line 6 to 7. So the world itself is of the quality of Elohim, which has the numerical value Hateva, which is concealment, Valyadei HaAvot, and through the patriarchs, Nimshach Shem Kel Shein Dalad Yud, it's drawn down, God Shein Dalad Yud. Now, Shein Dalad Yud is a mysterious name, and one is that it expresses the abundance of godly bounty. Ad sheyiflu sifsoteichem milomer dai dai dai, till your lips will wear out saying enough, enough, so much good things coming. So Shein Dalad Yud is expressing a tremendous bounty which is coming from God, which in a sense is perceiving the bounty. Of course, a person can look at life, you know, is the glass half full or half empty? But if one perceives the bounty and the goodness, one can perceive the Shein Dalad Yud, one perceives the godliness which is there. Now, putting that in Kabbalistic terms, if we look at our diagram, as we see in line 8, Ubeinyan, line 7 to 8. Ubeinyan Kael Shaddai, when we're talking about this name, Ita B'Sifrei Kabbalah, it says in books of Kabbalah, footnote 9 gives the reference to Pardes, which is by Rav Moshe Kodavero, Shehu Yichud Yesodu Malchut. The quality of Shein Dalad Yud represents the unification of Yesod and Malchut. Now, if you have a look at the diagram, Yesod is dedication. Malchut represents kingship, the feminine. And this is a kind of erotic bond. This is a bond where Yesod pours into Malchut this shefa, this flow which is coming from the divine into the world. Malchut, kingship, is the source of existence. You see, from kingship, the next step down is existence. And there's this flow coming from Yesod into Malchut, and that is represented by the name Shein Dalad Yud. Ubachasidutita, but in Hasidic teachings, we have another way of defining it. Shehu Yichud Yisrael Sava Utfuna. Now, what that means, this is a Lurianic phrase, Yisrael Sava Utfuna, and it means wisdom. It's talking about the upper two spheres, wisdom and understanding. So Tfuna is similar to the word Bina. So this Rabbi Isaac Luria, talking about the Sfirah, he explained that each Sfirah is in fact a Koma Shlema. It's a complete structure, which he called a Partzuf. Partzuf meaning a face in modern Hebrew. So each Sfirah has a whole dimension to it. And so Yisrael Sava and Tvuna, that is aspects of wisdom and understanding joining together and then causing a flow through the rest of the Sfirot. Ubechlalut u'inyan hamshachat ha-bina, which, going behind the Lurianic vocabulary, just simplifying it, it's a flow from bina, from understanding. Now, Bina has a lot of different qualities in the way in which the Kabbalists speak about it. One of the ways they speak about it is as the world to come. Olam Haba. Bina represents the world to come. If Malchut represents our world, Bina, which is the other main feminine sphera. Yes, you've got Malchut as a feminine sphera, and the most important other feminine sphera is understanding. And that is the source of Malchut, but on a much more spiritual level. So, for example, the Ark of Noah is described in Kabbalistic sources as representing the sphera Bina, like the world to come. The Sukkah that we sit in on Sukkot is like the Sphira Bina, it's the Makifin of Bina, it's the surrounding radiance of Bina, of understanding, which are there in the Schach of the Sukkah. So in other words, the Hasidic way of understanding what is happening from the Avot is that they draw a flow from understanding into the world. So it's that supernal flow revealing godliness which flows into the world. V'zehu, line 10, V'zehu achidush b'amshacha shenasit al yedei ha'avod. This is the new thing which is achieved by the patriarchs. L'fi she'tavut ha'olam mitzad atzmo mi'sfirat ha'malchut, because the coming into existence of the world by itself is from the sphere of Malchut. Ve'ilu ha'avot b'amshichim sfirat ha'bina, whereas the patriarchs draw down from Bina, from understanding, the higher sphere, which reveals godliness on a higher level, because on the level of Malchut, godliness is concealed. V'zeo gam ha'shekatub Baruch Hashem, Elokei Yisrael min ha'olam v'ad ha'olam, blessed is God, the God of Israel, from one world to the other world. Ve'ita b'zoh, and it says in the Zohar, min ha'olam hainu alma ilah, shu alma ditkasya. The Zohar says that when it says, blessed is God from one world to the other world, it means from the upper world, which is a hidden world, ad olam, till a lower world, alma tata shu alma ditkalya, a lower world which is revealed. Ve'hare klalut inyan alma ilah b'chinat ha'bina. In general, when we speak about an upper world which is higher, that is the quality of Bina, understanding. V'zeo inyan amshacha shal yedei avot. That is the flow which comes through the patriarchs. Now, we then have a section. It's a most beautiful section. I'm just so sorry that we don't have time to study it. But I've prepared a kind of a précis of part of it, which is on the back. This chart of the Sfirot, on the back, there's a précis of this concept. So I'm going to try and basically say, you know, outline this by heart, because otherwise we're not going to be able to get through to get, you know, even just to get to the end of the narrative of what the discourse is saying. So you see, it says here, page 8, from world to world, meaning from the hidden world to the revealed world. Now, the Kabbalists speak of four worlds. See them in Hebrew, and then their English translations. Atzilut, Bria, Yitzira, Asiya, which mean English words which have been chosen to try to explain these mystical concepts. Emanation, creation, formation, and action. And so those are four levels of world. Atzilut is the highest, which itself is really godliness. And below Atzilut is Bria, Yitzira, Asiya, the three lower worlds. We are in the lowest level of the world of action, the world of Asiya, and that's where our physical universe, or many universes, are. If we go into the world of Atzilut, so to speak, we then have the map of the Sfirot, as you've got on the back of this page. There are the three highest Sfirot, wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. And then the six Sfirot below, kindness, severity, mercy, victory, submission, dedication. And then finally, Malchut, kingship. Right? So there are these different gradations, if you like, in this Kabbalistic perspective of spiritual world. All these worlds are here. At any point where a person is, there are layers of existence, and so within where we are in the world of Asiya, the world of action. But if you saw more clearly, then we would see in the world of formation or creation or higher. Yeah, so it's everything is here. A spatial concept is used just for illustrative purposes. It's not as if these spiritual realms are higher. They're all here in this room with us. Only, of course, once you enter a spiritual realm, then the physicality of the room dissolves in various ways, and of ourselves, and our own being takes on different meanings. Now, what it says, what he's trying to explain, is what we mean by moving from the hidden and the revealed world. What do we call the hidden world and what's the revealed world? And he's beginning from the lowest level and moving up. And he gives four types of interpretation of what we mean. Now, there are different levels of hidden and revealed world. The first is that given these four realms, Bria, creation, is the hidden world. Yetzirah and Asiya are the revealed world. So those are in the world, Bria, Yetzirah, Asiya. In those three, the first one is hidden, the second two are revealed. Now, in fact, the world of Bria is Gan Eden. In fact, it's the Garden of Eden. In fact, the world of Bria is the upper Garden of Eden. The world of Yetzirah is the lower Garden of Eden. So we can understand that when you're talking about Asiya, the world of action, that's the lower world. And when we mean that from the higher world there is a flow down to this one, it comes from the world of Bria into the world of Yetzirah and Asiya. But the second way of looking at it is in a higher way. That Atzilut is the hidden world, and it's those lower three, Bria, Yetzirah, Asiya, those are the revealed ones. Then we can go higher still. That what we're talking about, number three, these Sfirot, these six Sfirot, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, these six Sfirot are the upper world, and Malchut is the revealed world. And the highest way of all, the fourth way, is that these three Sfirot, Chochma, Bina, Da'at, wisdom, understanding, and knowledge, those are the higher world, the upper hidden world, and then everything else is the lower realm. Now, there are mashalim, there are images, parables, in order to explain what we mean by a higher world and a lower world. And one of the images that we're going to try and focus on, he gives a number of images, each one of which is very beautiful, but we're only going to look at one. And that is thought. The difference between thought and speech. Because thought is a kind of radiant realm within us. It's a spiritual realm, comparatively. And speech is already something which is more external. And maybe we can try and see this inside. See, this is the first metaphor. The first metaphor is the idea of thought versus speech. So, okay, I think we can begin at the bottom of page Tet, where it says Ubiya Ha'inyan, which is chapter Gimel. Ubiya Ha'inyan, now explaining this, Dehina Madrega Rishona, the first level, B'shtei Olamot Elu, of these two worlds, the hidden world and the revealed world. Huba'olam Abriya Yitzira Asiya, is when we're talking about those three worlds alone. Right? So we're gonna. So that's creation, formation, and action. So we're talking about these three worlds. And the thing is that between them there is a kind of a line, and we're talking about a flow coming down from that higher level down below. Sholam Abriya Nikra Veshem Alma Ditkasya. The world of creation is called the hidden world, and the world of Yetzirah and Asiyah, they are called the revealed world. Ukmo Shekatuv, as it says in the prayer that we say every morning, Yotze Or Uvore Choshech. God forms light and creates darkness. Right? This is the beginning of the bracha before the Shema. God forms light and creates darkness. The Yitzirah, because the world of formation is a world of light and revelation. Ubriyahu Choshech Bekisui. And in comparison, the upper realm of creation is darkness and hidden. Even though this is a higher world, higher than the world of Yetzirah, as we find, when a man is praying and he's wearing tefillin, and when he says Yotze'or, he's supposed to touch the tefillin. That's a custom. When one says Yotze'or, one touches the tefillin shel yad. And when he says Borech Hoshech, he touches the tefillin shel rosh. So the idea is that the tefillin shel yad, the arm tefillin, are on a lower level. It's revelation, but it's on a lower level. And then we go to the higher level, which is concealment. And now the tefillin shel rosh, heim lemaile b'madregam et tefillin shel yad, the head tefillin are on a higher level than the arm tefillin. And that's actually the point. That something which is higher is more hidden. Because it is higher, liyoto nale yoter, because it's on a higher level, 9-5, hu behelem bekisu, it's concealed more. Lefisha ef shale kabel on nale kazeh, because it's impossible to receive such a bright radiance. The radiance in the world of creation is so hidden, is so intense, that it has to be hidden. Otherwise it would be blinding. And so therefore it has to be completely concealed. Whereas the radiance in the lower level is more visible, and therefore it's accessible to us. And so there you have the mashal of the letters of thought and the letters of speech. Now speech, this is line 9, in Yana Dibuhu Gilui Lezulato, when we speak, we're revealing something to another person. Machshavah Behelim La'atzmo, whereas thought is something inside our own minds, it's just private. Shahadei Yachol Lachshov Kol Hayom, a person could think all day long, V'zulato Lo Yedaklau, and the other person won't know about it at all. Da'av Shezulato Yagishu Ma'amik B'machshavto, even though the other person can feel that you're thinking very deeply. But they don't know what you're thinking about. Can irritate people. What are you thinking about? Nothing. You won't understand. You can find the most irritating answer to get. Don't ask. I haven't got the time to tell you now. I'll tell you tomorrow. So the other person doesn't know what you're thinking. The reason why the letters of thought are concealed from the other person, because thoughts are more subtle. Thought is joined to the soul. And there shines into thought the intense radiance of the soul. Now, This is a interesting person who's thinking. Many of us, we might think, but we don't feel this flow from the soul. But if you imagine a certain intensity of thinking, that when the person is thinking, there is something flowing into their mind from the soul. So,
like the subconscious feeding the conscious.
Yes. I'm thinking in terms of, let's say, an artistic activity, where the artist at that moment is tapping into some deep dimension of his or her inner being, and that is what is flowing out and is being expressed, whether on the canvas or in music or in writing, whatever it might be. So there's some kind of inner flow which is taking place. And there, this idea of the radiance flowing into the thought. Now, thought, see, with art, it's very interesting, because the thought is somehow, it's as if thought is almost leaped over, because the artist has got a way of immediately putting something on the canvas or writing words. And sometimes the thought is so intense that he's not an artist, because he doesn't write. And many great Jewish leaders were like this. They didn't write. Rabbi Yitzhak Luria, the great Kabbalist of the 16th century, he wrote almost nothing. And he said he can't write because he's got a river of thought. And he can't see how to squeeze the river of thought into a narrow pen to write words on paper. And many Hasidic leaders, including the late Lubavitcher Rebbe, much of their output were oral teachings, where it's only a step from the thought to the speech, and rather than actually writing it down, it was their students who listened to what they were saying and wrote it down, and that was what was edited into books. And when the Rebbe would himself do the last stage of editing.
Well, that's a bit like the law being oral originally and then written down later.
The oral law itself, that's a very good point. The oral law is a channel of a stream of oral teachings, which eventually gets focused into the Mishnah and the Talmud. That's a very good point. And you can feel sometimes in the Talmudic transcription the intensity of this transmission, which is being packaged rendered in the Talmudic phraseology. Now, he gives an example to understand the difference between thought and speech. The Kasher Adam Nimtza, this is line 17. Kasher Adam Nimtza b'tnua shel tokef hamidot. When a person is feeling intense emotion, azay eino yachol ledaber klal. He's not able to speak at all. It might be a very positive, beautiful emotion, which just cannot be expressed in words. Or it might be some tremendous grief, God forbid. Lefi shetokef hamida iavshah shetitgale bedibur. The strength of that emotion he feels cannot be expressed in words. Ukmochem besechel. Sometimes also with an idea, not an emotion, but an idea in the mind. The tremendous radiance of the mind can't contract itself into letters of speech. Now this is, whereas in the case of thought, this is line 20. Whereas in the case of thought, you can get a tremendous radiance of intellect and the power of emotion in a stream of thoughts. That's what James Joyce was trying to communicate, yes? The intensity of a stream of consciousness. Umitzad ribu oa nefesh b'machshava, because of the great radiance of the soul which is in the thought. Iev shash yitgaleh or lazulat. You can't communicate that radiance. You can't reveal that radiance to anyone else. Ki im la'atzmo dafka, but just to oneself. Now, How come we can communicate it to ourselves? Because a person has, we have an instant access to ourselves. If we do. Many people don't. One of the great problems of our time, I think, particularly our deraciné time, is people are not open to themselves. We have this concept in English, a person has a persona, which is a mask. So one level is where they put on the mask in order to relate to other people, and they smile nicely to everyone. The other problem is when the mask is also for themselves, and they have no, they're never able to take the mask off. So here we're talking on a sort of a more ideal level, that the person has somehow broken through this barrier, or doesn't have that barrier. The person is karov etzel atzmo, he or she is open to himself. L'chein davka l'atzmo efshar sh'yitkale o ha-nefesh, and therefore to himself or herself, hi, how are you? This spirituality can be revealed. Right, you've come on just the most beautiful part, which is page Yud. Are you? Okay.
Thank you.
David, you've got to keep up. So we're talking about a very, very intense experience or intense radiance in the mind, and it flows into the person's thoughts, and it's not held back from flowing into their thoughts, because the person is open to themselves. If the person's closed to themselves, they're frightened to think. They don't want to think. And, or more complicated postures. And you have an intensity of mind or of emotion which isn't able to enter thought in a balanced way. So it comes in a wild, psychotic way or something like that, where it is in a way of disorder. The intensity of the pressure, the inner pressure, is so strong that it's not able to be processed by thought, and it becomes something which is damaging in the person's structure. Here we're talking about a very idealized and beautiful whole person who is able to access their own intensity of spiritual experience within their mind and their emotions, and it flows into their thoughts. L'chein davka, this is line 24, therefore specifically la'atzmo efshar sh'yitkale o ha-nefesh, therefore the person is able to experience the revelation of this radiance of the soul to himself or herself. V'hainu shegam hakirva yote gdola shel azulat, and that means even when you have another person who is incredibly close, kumo hakirva da'av va'ach, like the closeness of a father or the closeness of a brother. When I was reading this afternoon, I wondered, why doesn't he say the closeness of a spouse, of a wife or of a husband, where we have a concept, ishto kagufo, a man's spouse is like himself, that's a man and wife are like one being. Anyway, here it's just father and brother. Eino maspika, or maybe that helps us understand the answer. Hakirva da'av va'ach, even when we're talking about a tremendous closeness such as a father or a brother, he's still not able to feel the other person's thought. And the radiance, the revelation of the radiance of the soul which is in his thought is dafka for him himself alone. Maybe that's why he doesn't say a spouse, because perhaps in an idealized spouse situation, one can feel the thought and one can feel the radiance which is there. behind the form. You know, that's the sense of bond which, with the help of God, some husbands and wives are blessed with. Lefish Adam karov etzel atzmo, but for oneself, see, even for himself, I am stressing, it's not such an easy business. Because many people are closed up to themselves, let alone them having a relationship with anyone else. They have a problem having a relationship with themselves. And this is talking about in sort of idealized terms.
But we're full of thoughts all the time. We can't stop. It's very hard to stop thinking. And does it really mean that every thought is lighted with our nefesh?
You know, thoughts, our thoughts bounce off different things. So a person, you know, you see a newspaper headline, so your thought starts revolving around that newspaper headline. Then you see a picture, a poster on the wall, your thought starts revolving around that. Then, now, some people are more focused. And they are trying to communicate with themselves. They're walking in the woods. So is one going to waste the time walking in the woods thinking about the newspaper headline? Perhaps, you know, perhaps it's not a waste of time. Perhaps that's a valuable thing to think about. But the person is going to think about it in a way which is more true to themselves. It's not just noise. We live in a society where there's an enormous amount of noise.
So it's not any
psychic
thought.
Psychic noise.
It's not any thought.
I agree
talking
with you.
About specific
I agree with you. I agree with you.
So how can you define?
That's why I'm saying it's a special situation. If it's not a special person, it's a special situation. I believe that it's quite possible for people to live 80 years and most of the time not experience this at all. Because the radiance of their soul is completely blocked from them. And their thoughts, I mean, we live in a remarkable period of time. Many, like, you know, children's discourse in classrooms very often is just reflections of different TV programs. You know, they're saying this, like this TV program, and someone else says that, like that TV program. You can sit down and chart what everyone is saying according to the cultural waves of our particular epoch, you know, and where we come from.
It's always been the way, though.
Yes, there's an interesting study. Of you see, there's chozrim b'tshuva, which is people who, so to speak, repent and become observant Jews. And then there's the opposite term. Do you know the opposite term?
Chozer
b'tshuva. Chozer b'sheila. That's right. Returning to the question. Returning to, see, tshuva means repentance, and it also means answer. So there's a wonderful modern Israeli phrase, chozrim b'sheila, people who go back to the question. In other words, dropouts, Ramesh, Arim, or somewhere like that, who try to live in ordinary secular Israeli society, or wherever it might be. More research has been done in Israel than anywhere else. So someone wrote a beautiful article studying a group of Baalei Tshuva and a group of chozrim b'sheila. Of chozrim b'tshuva and chozrim b'sheila, people who went back to the repentance and people who went back to the question. And the writer of the article, it was published in some psychological journal, which my wife showed. So the interesting finding was that chozrim b'sheila, those who went back to the question in the context of Israeli society, tended to be less happy. But I mean, there were many factors for that. But one of the points why they were less happy is that no one understood their jokes. After 25 years being in an atmosphere of Talmudic and Midrashic discourse, whether one's a man or a woman, you know, it's there's certain jokes, there's a whole cultural bond, you know, a whole cultural resource. Suddenly no one understands what you're talking about.
And vice versa.
I don't know how literary the jokes in modern Israel are. See, if you talk about modern England with a traditional education where one person says a quip from Marlowe and another one responds with Shakespeare. Yes.
As they do.
Sometimes.
In the right circles, maybe.
I don't actually really agree with you, Tully, because I think how about people who are versed in modern culture and grew up in modern culture, and then they have that background. I mean, it's just everyone according to, you know, it's like different social groups. I mean, just you're really talking just about the social groupings. I don't really see that there's a qualitative edge there, because whether it's Marlowe and Shakespeare, or whether it's, you know, Rashi and Rambam, or whether it's sort of, I don't know, something from modern culture, they're all basically just different groups who have their own...
Alright, you know? Well, I'm amused by this study. I didn't write the study. And I think that, you know, you could ask that question on the study. You know, why is there any difference? Why isn't the Chozer b'she'elah? Why doesn't the Chozer b'tshuva, the person who's entered an Orthodox lifestyle, do they feel deprived if they can't quote Kafka? But they can quote Kafka.
So I think the difference is... You're going to say something, say it, and then I'll...
Alright, so I think that you can quote Kafka in an Orthodox society, whereas if you quote something from Rav and Shmuel in a secular Israeli society, they actually don't understand what you're talking about. Not only that, they've negated that. It's meaningless. That's the Talmud. That's what we're running away from.
Yeah, I have to disagree with you, because I think that if you come from popular culture into
drunk culture, try quoting drunk culture.
Exactly. Unless somebody was also a Chozer LaTshuva who'd come from the same background, and therefore they would have the same cultural references.
You're right. You're right that, first of all, there could be a process of suppression of cultural identity. I think in Chabad there tends to be a way of enhancing.
But there's also a huge amount of Chozer LaTshuva in Chabad as well.
Yeah.
Lots of
so they can all communicate with each other about art or jazz.
I don't know, all the South Africans are all, you know, they've got the same background.
Yeah, that's true.
I think it's an interesting question. I think it's about what you miss. Because if you miss something, and it's out of bounds. So if you're born up in a secular thing and you miss bacon, you just can't have it if you're religious. Whereas if you become unreligious, you can have everything and you can choose. So there's a different experience. You know, you make choices that are different. And the other thing is to do with the people that I find that have left religion haven't left the Torah. They haven't left their love of Torah. They haven't left their studying of Torah. They've just left their practice, how they exercise that, what they do with that knowledge. So I don't know that anything ever changes on some level with any Jewish person. I just think it's the outward stuff that we see. We don't really know what goes on inside, and I'd argue that it can be no different for anybody on some level.
All right, well that's very interesting.
I have also read about people like artists who've become religious, become Chazor LaTshuva LaHaredi, who have tremendous problems for not being allowed to paint in the way that they were allowed to paint, because it like blocks off an outlet that they always had, like representational painting and things like that. That created real problems for them.
Yeah, although there are lots of poskim who say they can paint representational paintings, but I'm concerned about a deeper problem with art, which in fact Chaim Potok wrote this book, two books. One's called My Name is Asher Lev, and then a sequel, where he talks about a Hasidic artist. And what he's trying to present, the thesis he's trying to present, is that
art needs a certain ability to break through barriers. And he is claiming that if you're a religious person and your life is ruled by the Torah, then how can you break through barriers? Now, the answer to that might be that, in fact, the way in which the world discloses itself through the kind of teaching that we're exploring over here is, in fact, in a very essential way, one is able to see what the deep barriers in existence are, and indeed to break through those barriers. And one might express that in art, you know, and so that would be a kind of answer. The question is, who is actually doing that artistically? And it's very hard to point to anyone clearly who is doing that, because most quote-unquote, you know, religious art or Hasidic art is celebratory in some sense. It celebrates...
Of the texts and things like that.
Well, it's, you know, like this picture here. It's very beautiful, and it's by a very, very skilled artist. But it's celebrating a kind of, you know, a spiritual experience. But the spiritual experience is there in the picture rather than...
It's interesting, because you know my friend Eitan Amir... His art is mainly, actually, although he's not religious on a day-to-day basis, his art is, because of he's studied in yeshiva and everything, a lot of his work is religious.
Mm.
So he does, for example, the hands of the Kohanim and lots of religious subjects. It's very interesting that he takes from... So he's actually dipped very deeply into that as a source.
Your friend,
Elliot.
Yeah. The very intense spiritual dimension.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I wouldn't anyway say that art studying text blocks.
Well, what Potok is saying, not so much studying text, but the whole. Since you're living in a Hasidic lifestyle, so you have to, you know, you have to be like everyone.
Mm.
But
yeah.
Artists also have their lifestyle. There was once, just after the mezuzah campaign began, which was like persuading people to have a mezuzah on their doors or have the mezuzah that they've got checked, a famous pianist happened to come to London, a Jewish pianist. And together with a friend of mine, we went to visit him. And the whole goal of our visit was to ask him, would he like to have a mezuzah? And we had this lovely conversation. And then finally, and he was extremely sensitive, interesting, you know, profound person, finally came round to the mezuzah. You know, would you like to have a mezuzah?
Thank you.
Well, I found the answer extremely striking, which I've never forgotten. He said, I couldn't have a mezuzah because none of my friends have a mezuzah. He was completely trapped. You know, in the concert pianist world, he is trapped. He has to do what other concert pianists do. So having a mezuzah would be...
That's the rules.
That's right. And I felt, you know, never.
Go to the other.
It was basically too weird for him. It was like he couldn't...
Yes, it's...
Interesting.
But it's as if, I mean, there was some...
This is a very extreme discipline, of course.
There was a Tony Hancock film about this, made in the 60s or whenever it was that Hancock was acting. So it's about a man who runs away from the city and goes to live in Paris and becomes an artist. And so he's describing what it's like in the city. How everyone there wears exactly the same clothes. They all wear pinstripe suits and, you know, whatever it is they wear. They're all exactly the same. And as he's telling this story, the camera is first of all focusing on him. And you see his face with a beard and a polo neck black sweater. And then slowly the camera moves back and he's sitting with 30 people, every one of whom has a beard and a black polo neck sweater. You know, so, so But it's still a question. You know, I'd like to find the artist who is actually breaking barriers through his or her art. Maybe there are. And so I gave a paper discussing this at the British Association of Jewish Studies last summer. And someone there, one of the artists that I was describing, who had become religious, so someone there in the lecture, he knew this artist. He said, yes, as soon as he became religious, his art became much worse. Which was awful, you know, like suddenly stereotyped instead of this dramatic. And so it's a puzzle which hasn't been
solved. I mean, the opposite of it.
That's true. Yeah.
Michael Train.
That's right. Yeah.
What do you mean?
John Coltrane wanted to get to God, basically, through his playing.
Okay. What's the name?
John Coltrane.
John Coltrane.
The African-American saxophonist.
Yeah.
And he was all the time breaking barriers.
They have a little church in San Francisco, in a shop. I happened to be there.
John Coltrane Church.
Yeah. It's not a it's in a shop, actually, but they play lovely music. It. And I asked them, I paid for them to send me CDs of his music because I liked it.
Isn't there somehow a difference between art as decoration or music as fluffy sort of stuff and the truth of what you're trying to express and being true to yourself somehow?
I agree with you. That's exactly the point that Bartok makes. But when he's like in the conversation with the artist in the book, he says, yes, you can do calendar art, you know, decorative art, in other words, celebratory art. But the real thing, you have to be on some edge. You have to be out on an edge.
And it's about being true from inside.
Yes.
Because you can't actually necessarily know if somebody's telling the truth. It's about...
That's right.
...the right connection somehow.
Well, quote-unquote, an art connoisseur would feel that when they look at just the line, just the way that colour is being used, they can feel that that is real, you know, that's something real. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about the figure in Potok's book, Asher Lev, is he always remains basically an Orthodox Jew with a very strong Hasidic dimension. It's all revolving around the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he takes the advice of the Rebbe. The Rebbe advises him all kinds of things, including to move away, because what he's doing is upsetting people, because he made a crucifixion picture with his mother being crucified. And so that scandalized everyone in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. And he had to do it, you know, that was his feeling. He had to do it. But in fact, as a person, he remained a Hasid, and he married a Hasidic woman from a good Russian Hasidic family.
You do also get artists who are decorative, I think, and towards the end of their life, things change. And the example I can think of, particularly with that, is Matisse, who I think's work is quite decorative, and he has wonderful lines, and he's a beautiful artist, but his stuff is decorative. And towards the end of his life, when he couldn't really paint anymore because he had arthritis, I can't remember what the reason was, he was just doing these colour blocks, and he was using his feet to sort of, you know, to stick them on and things like that, and they were getting students to help him, and it becomes amazingly, amazingly pure.
That's very interesting.
And then the other example, the most spiritual work I've ever seen, is the Monet water lilies, which are right at the end of his life, which I've seen en masse, you know, as a group in Paris years ago. And they're just amazingly, amazingly pure. And if not, I think Monet was always a great artist, unlike Matisse. I mean, he was a great, you know, very great artist. But like one of the other impressionists and, you know, whatever, one of the great artists. But at the end of his life, he was drawing, painting this stuff that it just, you know, absolutely, the spirituality absolutely leaps off at you, you know?
That's interesting, this concept of progression.
I had a lecture of Prof. Steinsaltz about art in the Israeli Museum,
And he said that really a great work of art needs to have something sacred in it.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. That's nice. That's very beautiful.
It's just a thought I've got, but I wonder if when people leave the religion, if it's linked to the mother very strongly, as opposed to, like, I don't know if there's any research being done, but in terms of when a mother, you know, mother, woman marries and guy's religious, woman kind of becomes less religious, and there's a divorce or something, then the kids would go it's towards that. Well, I've heard it, the two instances that I know. What are you saying?
It's normally the other way, the woman has the influence of the family, so if the woman...
Yeah,
so
the woman becomes less religious, then the children may become less religious, mm-hmm. is what I'm saying.
That could be. I'd
imagine that.
I heard you the opposite, for example.
Oh, really? That the man, they'd follow the man?
Mm.
No, that's not what Nicole's saying. She's saying about a woman being more religious and the children therefore being more religious.
Yeah, I'm talking about woman leave the religion and then...
Well, look, it could be, you know...
It's linked to the happiness. So I'm saying that the choice... I'm really arguing that to do with the happiness and whatever is another thing. It's to do with...
But all the complex situations people get into can move this way and it can move that way. Let's just... Okay. Okay. Hopefully you'll be able to hear the end. Yes, yeah, you'll be able to hear the end on the web.
Oh. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, we better, it has got late, and I want to try. You see, what he goes on to say, he gives a whole series of stages. If we look at this page, steps from the second point, page 11, steps from the essence of the soul to thought. You see here, you've got the essence of the soul, and then the nefesh ha-maskelet, the intellectual soul, which is like another level. And then you've got from the soul, it then moves into the intellect. And that intellect includes the divine intellect on the one hand, the divine seichel, and the natural seichel. And then that goes higher and higher, or lower. We're actually talking about it going from the essence of the soul into, finally, thought. Now, all those processes are transparent. They're with selflessness. They're with bitul. The movement into thought is like, it doesn't have the ego. The ego is not there because no one else can see you thinking. You're able to think in an egoless way. It's a very, very interesting idea which is presented here.
So that's when the light, the divine light is on your thoughts? When yes. you are able to think without ego?
Yes, yes. And of course, I would add, without noise. It can't just be the chattering of some TV program rattling through one's mind.
Very close to meditation.
Yeah. Mm.
Isn't it?
Well,
losing the ego, you know, and
well, look, Chabad is a huge library of books on meditation. You know? Yeah.
But meditation says that you can feel egoless if you stop the thoughts. If you manage to stop thinking, then you can feel...
Declare yourself.
Yeah, now Chabad is different. Yeah. In Chabad, you have a concept of actual positive thoughts through which there is no ego. You're expressing a divine radiance from within. That's the big difference from Chabad and Eastern meditation.
Say that again?
The difference between Chabad and Eastern meditation is that in Eastern meditation, generally one is trying to reach a thoughtless state, no thought. Wu Wei, yes, no mind. And saying a mantra, you know, where you only have the mantra, there's no structured thought of any kind. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Chabad teaching, there's the idea that you can have thought, and in fact these teachings we're looking at are precisely this kind of thought, that one is able to have these thoughts and they are radiant with one's own radiance.
I think it's the same because when you stop, when you go into meditation, I'm doing a lot of meditation. When you're going into a meditative mode and you manage to stop the noise and really to empty your mind, then you can have some thoughts, but they really rise from inside of you. Mm. And they are slower, much slower, and maybe that's the same thing.
All right.
Maybe that's the same okay. thing. But it's very rare to get into this situation. It's not easy at all.
Mm-hmm. All right.
It's half thought, half emotion. It's really not a sharp thought. It's something in between.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's very rare. And I've never felt any light.
You've never felt something?
No.
All right. But here, it's talking about a channel, which is a channel of radiance. So it's... I mean, that could maybe prepare you for thoughts of this time, which, I mean, you see, just the simple word, Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz, at the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. That can become a doorway to radiance, which then fills the mind and the heart of the person.
Bereshit bara is a door for radiance?
The concept that in the beginning God created heaven and earth, in your mind's eye, that's an enormous vista. Shamayim, heavens. Eish v'mayim, fire and water. Earth, aretz. Bereshit. The word Bereshit, you know, there's a book of the Zohar which takes 70 different combinations of the word Bereshit, and each combination it explains in a different way. Tikkuni Zohar.
So you mean meditating on it, on Bereshit bara Elokim?
Yeah.
Can.
But that's dependent on your knowledge, isn't it? You've got to meditate on your information.
You've got a very good point. That's a major problem.
You can't just meditate if you...
That's a deep issue with Judaism. In fact, Shlomo Levine, whom you probably know, he has this wonderful party piece where he describes the process of someone trying to convert to Judaism who was not very intelligent. It's extremely hard to convert to Judaism if you're not, you know, don't read and think. And it was a tremendous struggle, you know, and Shlomo describes this in a very graphic way. How this person like struggled and really wanted to convert and do everything right, you know, but there's just so many intellectual layers of reading and of thinking and of study and, of, you know, so... And being Jewish, you know, there's always the invitation, come and study Torah. And it's on this level, on that level.
You know, the American comedian and commentator Lenny Bruce said there's nothing quite as gory as converting to Judaism because no Jew ever did it.
Well, sometimes they do. Yeah, I mean, it's a modern phenomenon. People who believe they're Jewish, but can't prove it.
What do you think?
So they convert to Judaism.
Do you believe in that? I mean, do you believe people really have that?
What? If a person...
Like they believe they've got a Jewish soul and they convert.
I mean, well, it's not so much that they believe they have a Jewish soul. I mean, that by all means, a person like that, you know, maybe they will convert, yeah. But here I'm talking about people who have the memory in their family that their grandparents were Jewish, you know, maybe on both sides, but then all the documentation disappeared and it was in the war and stuff like
that's
that.
That's different.
Yeah, but that's... person who feels they want to, you know, they want to convert to Judaism. That's quite, there are many converts. Around the millennium, there were lots of converts. Lots of people wanting.
Lots of people in Prague interested in that, I read. Because Chabad are very active in Prague, and it became a big social scene. And lots of non-Jews became very interested in Judaism. I think it's a little bit like, you know, people becoming interested in Indian religion. You know, drawn to Buddhism. To some, I think. I don't think it's this amazing like it's a non-Jewish soul that wants to become Jew. I don't see it in that. You can see it in that way, but I wouldn't see it in that way.
The Kabbalists say it's a Jewish soul which has been planted in a non-Jewish environment.
That's very interesting.
And the reason they say that, one of the reasons is the Mishnah says, Ger shenit gayer, a proselyte who becomes a proselyte. It doesn't say a non-Jew, goy shenit gayer. A non-Jew becomes a proselyte. It says a proselyte who becomes a proselyte. So from the very beginning they were, so they had that soul. Yeah.
That's very interesting. But that's very, it's also quite logical in a way. It's quite a,
Yeah. All right, so we have this concept of this radiance of the mind. I'm sorry, it's gone on terribly, terribly late. We have this concept of the radiance of the mind. However, when it comes to speech, that's already a gap. That's like comparatively a darkness. So we have this realm here, which in this imagery is being described as the mind and thought, which is radiant, or it's an inner radiant, and then we have the and then we have the world of speech and action, which are on a much lower level. So the point is that at the beginning, speech and action. So at the beginning of existence, we have the situation where the world is created in this concealed way. Everything is concealed, like the level of speech and action. The Avot, the patriarchs, they tried to draw from the radiance, from the higher level, into the world. They're trying to reveal godliness. And that's the name, She and Dalad Yud. They're trying to reveal godliness in the world. Now Korach, the story of Korach, Ve'itpalag, he divided. He wanted to divide, and there's a whole lot of like different Hasidic commentaries outside Chabad as well, Rabbi Elimelech of Lizhensk. Korach was trying to say, look, there is a division in the world. That's why Korach means bald. Like, there's a bald patch. There's the hair one side, and the hair the other side, and there's a bald patch in the middle. Here's the bald patch. He's saying, yes, there's the spiritual realm, and we Levites, we're involved with the spiritual realm. And then there's the ordinary people. They're in a dark place. Forget about them. You can't do anything with them. And this is against the whole ethos of what Moses is about. Moses is trying to say, you can bring the radiance to everyone. And so therefore the whole process, the problem which has to be fought in the case of Korach is the suggestion that this is an unbreachable barrier. And Moses is saying, no, this barrier can be breached. And in fact, that's exactly what Yaakov wanted to do. Jacob is one of the patriarchs who is trying to breach this barrier and bring down this radiance. And even more than Jacob, Moses, and who does bring down that that radiance, moving on an even higher level, not only She and Dalad Yud, but the Tetragrammaton, the four-letter name of God. And so therefore, that's why Korach, there's the suggestion that he's going to be connected to his great ancestor, Jacob, because that is the issue. Can Jacob's work be fulfilled in our generation, like in Korach's generation, of revealing the radiance of the higher dimension, the mind, so to speak, the mind of existence, into the thought and action of existence? And Korach was saying, leave a barrier there, which was really a kind of a social barrier. We holy people, we Levites, we're on that exalted level, and all the ordinary people are much lower. And that was the argument, because the Torah is about revealing godliness for everyone. So that's basically the story of this.
Thank you. Sorry to extend your
time. No, that's fine. I'm sorry. We did go rather a long time.
That's marvelous. Thank you.
That's really interesting.
Thank you.